Hey, this is Paul. If you're looking behind me, you can see that I've been working on my office project, and I am not that little corner back there where there's still a little bit of mess. That has been where I have been recording video for the last 4 years plus. And I am now recording video from the area there that I did a lot of other work on. So the idea is to sort of integrate all of the video and all of the work into one area, and I'm still working out the bugs. You'll probably see that things will change here, but that's why. Different scenery. Those of you who caught me on Jacob's live stream today, I thought we had a good conversation. Talked with Sam, talked with Jacob. Someone on Twitter sent me a request to see, now my hands are in different places. I'm gonna have to have all this muscle memory about what to do where. So Hillary's birthday party contacted me on Twitter and said that Joe Rogan and Matt Walsh disagree over gay marriage, and thought, well, this might be an interesting video. I actually didn't find the video very interesting at all. In some ways, the video, see, now I was very much boxed into that little corner and I couldn't move anywhere. And now I've got lots of room to move. But if you want to hear me, I got to get nice up close to the mic and we'll see if Rick complains about this contraption. I could put it on the other side, Rick, and then you'd see less of it, and maybe Rick will be happy. But I have participated in and watched this argument many, many, many times. Joe Rogan basically says, hey, so what if a gay person's marriage doesn't affect a straight person's marriage? You've heard this from politicians. You've heard this from all kinds of other people. And to a degree, they're right. That isn't exactly the same as saying that a change in the definition of marriage doesn't change everyone's marriage. And that's where, on one hand, when Joe Rogan says, well, if these two gay people love each other and get married, what? How does that hurt your heterosexual marriage? Very true. If the cultural definition of marriage changes, that very well might, and in fact likely will, impact all marriages, and the definition of marriage has been changing for a very long time. Oh, see, now I'm, yeah, there's still a lot of things I'm going to have to work out in this rig. Yeah, every time it changes, things impact the workflow, so I'm facing the wrong directions because I've got some notes over here, and I've got screens here, and I've got the camera here, so all of this stuff will probably be changing quite a bit over the next little while, but we will soldier on. First point in this conversation. So if you ever have this conversation with someone on whatever side you are, consider these points. First point, what I call universal marriage, which has been around for a long time. You can find it cross-culturally all over the world. And there was, for the most part, a great degree of understanding and commonality with respect to what marriage is for. What did universal ancient marriage do? Number one, it made family members, it made tribe members out of non-tribe, non-family members. It's one of the key things marriage does. Marriage takes a person who is not a part of your family and puts them in your family. It takes a person who is not a part of your tribe and puts them in your tribe. You might say, well, what does that matter? Well, if you're living in a tribal world where the difference between life and death, between eating and not eating, between being on this land and not being allowed to be on this land depends on whether or not you are part of this tribe. It's a very big deal. And so that's one universal understanding of what marriage is for. Number two, marriage by virtue, and this sounds a little weird, marriage makes legal heirs. What does that mean? It means that the children of the union are also members of the tribe. If you read the book of Genesis very carefully and you look very closely at the relationship between Abram and Sarah, she is his half-sister. If you look at who Abram looked for wives, for his, for Isaac, and then Isaac for Jacob, and they looked for someone within their tribe to marry. Tribe was tremendously important. So not only is marriage able, at least sometimes, because of course there, you know, Rebecca didn't really like Esau's choice in wives. And so this whole issue about being within the tribe, keeping things within the tribe, making someone not of your family, in your family, these are very old and very ancient. And again, through much of human history, tribal stuff was really important and very significant. So that's what marriage did. And then even as the tribal stuff sort of receded, marriage was all about the creation of legitimate heirs. And so when you get to the classical period, you can discover this. There's a lot of information out there on the internet. Sex was not restricted to marriage, especially for men. Because, well, men, women in a marriage were supposed to maintain the purity of the lineage of the seed. And there's all kinds of discussion about how people thought about reproduction. You look at seed, you look at a lot. For a long time in human history, people imagined that the man implants the seed in the woman, and she's, for the most part, sort of this fertile soil out of which the child grows, as if the child is in the seed itself. We today, of course, have this idea about you've got a sperm and you've got an egg, and it's the union of these two, and they come about. We can talk about that when we get to Christianity and how the Apostle Paul changes these assumptions about marriage. But these are the ideas that, well, marriage is about the creation of legitimate heirs. There's a very common saying from antiquity, which basically makes the point that wives are for having legitimate heirs. Courtesans are for men's entertainment. These were basically high class, educated, we would call them prostitutes or escorts that could be for the amusement of a wealthy, high status male, and then slaves for men's daily needs. And this, what you see in there was that it was assumed in the classical period, in the Roman Greek period, that men did not limit their sexual behavior to their wives. It was whatever women thought of it, however women liked it or didn't like it, men would be able to have sex with slaves, with courtesans. In the Roman period, when you get into the question of same-sex behavior, it was thought that a good Roman man should penetrate, not be penetrated by. Okay, and there's a big discussion about same-sex behavior in ancient Rome and in the classical period and in the Greek period. I'm not going to go into that in that video because it doesn't really get into the definition of marriage, except for the fact that the only reason you marry someone is for the creation of legitimate heirs or to bring them somehow within your social circles or within your tribe. And so what happens to a degree is that social circles become sort of quasi-tribes. And so that's where you get the idea of marrying up. You want your children to marry up, and you want your children to improve the family's position. And you can still find many cultures around the world where the purpose of marriage is to bind families together for business, for status, for the future of the family, so that they can all move forward together. These are not uncommon ideas in the world today. Now, I've been preaching in my Rough Draft for Sunday through 1 Corinthians. And when you get to 1 Corinthians 7, the Apostle Paul says something which is dramatic. He says first that the husband's body, or the wife's body, belongs to her husband. And nobody would have made a big deal about that. Everybody would have simply assumed it. But then he says that the husband's body belongs to his wife. That is revolutionary. That is deeply mutual. And you see, if you look at the Tom Wright, Tom Holland conversation on Unbelievable from a few years ago, they talked about this as a depth charge within Roman society. That saying becomes the groundwork for the creation of what in the middle of the 20th century in the Christian West and in North America in particular would assume would be the definition of Christian marriage and would be basically the definition of Protestant marriage and therefore the definition of American cultural marriage in mainstream American life. That sex was reserved exclusively for marriage. That is an innovation in marriage that very much grows out of the Pauline New Testament. Now, some of our Jewish friends and listeners can probably school me on to what degree this was assumed by the traditions in First Temple Judaism or in the day. I would assume that Paul didn't make this solely out of whole cloth, but this is in some ways in continuation. But Paul says it, and he says it very starkly, and he teaches it to the church in Corinth. And this teaching then goes on through Christian history. It becomes very restrictive of male sexuality. Okay, there were already a lot of restrictions on female sexuality, at least within a household where there was economic, material, and political concerns about legitimate heirs. All right. 200-300 years ago, we had the psychologization of marriage. It doesn't mean that the other issues went away, but that increasingly marriage became a vehicle for romantic fulfillment. And you can find all sorts of period pieces about this. Whereas I am sure that throughout history, many young women were not terribly excited about having to marry some far older, high-status, wealthy male because they wanted to marry for love. You can even find hints of that in the Book of Ruth, where Ruth pursues Boaz, and Boaz compliments Ruth for showing him the kindness of expressing her interest in him rather than going after other young men. So these ideas that we have currently in our world that are simply common by virtue of what we would imagine to be, what we would assume to be normal biology, these were not unknown in the ancient world, but there were reasons why families would want to marry a young woman to an older man, and there were some reasons why that didn't always work out too badly for the young woman. She had to, maybe if he was a good guy, a nice guy, she'd have to deal with him for a few years, but he'd probably die young and leave her a ton of money, and she could live quite comfortably as a widow with status and power. If you look at the French Revolution, you can find some of these women who were widows of high-status, wealthy men, basically began hosting philosophical conversations for the philosophers. And I mean, there's just lots of this kind of thing that you can find in the world. Perhaps if you look at Lydia in the Book of Acts, she was a seller of purple cloth. She didn't seem to have a husband in the book. We don't know for sure. She didn't seem to have a husband. She was clearly a wealthy woman. She was clearly had status. She may very well have been someone who eventually became taken as a wife by a high-status older male, and when that man died, she, in a sense, inherited his kingdom. And that was a way that women could have a significant amount of wealth, a significant amount of status, and a significant amount of power, even in the ancient world. But, like I said, 200 or 300 years ago, the definition of marriage began to migrate as marriage is for romantic fulfillment. And that change deeply impacted the West, and you can find it in movies, and it deeply impacted ideas and assumptions within the church. Now, what you have when you arrive at, let's say, the common cultural assumptions about sexual propriety come the middle and late 20th century, you have basically the elements of all of these social evolutionary steps where marriage is about legitimate heirs. The word bastard is still floating around. Marriage is about legitimate heirs. Marriage is a way that you take a non-family member and they become a part of the family. We have all sorts of rituals around that. Marriage, thanks to the Apostle Paul, is supposed to be a very mutual thing. And in Western Europe, polygamy goes away, and it's one-on-one. And again, that's another impact of the New Testament. And then you have the psychologizing and the romanticizing of marriage. Marriage is supposed to yield a good, which is fulfillment, romantic love, and you can see it in Jerry Maguire, "You complete me." So you have all of these elements now balled into marriage. Now, when Joe Rogan talks to Matt Walsh, Joe Rogan predominantly thinks of that psychologized romantic understanding of, all of this understanding of what marriage is for. And so he will say to Matt Walsh, well, if a gay couple has romantic feelings about each other, a gay couple has sexual feelings for each other, within the Western definition of marriage, that seems like the best way to go. That, well, the pinnacle of it is getting married. You find this if you watch The Bachelor or Bachelorette. The pinnacle of one's life is romantic union in marriage, and everyone on The Bachelor and Bachelorette wants the whole thing for themselves. And many of these people have come from broken homes, and they're all on the show saying, we want life to be, I want to find my person, because they're sensitive to other concerns in society. I want to find my person, and I want it to be for life. Often you'll hear people say things like, I'm looking for unconditional love. But of course, the irony in a show like that is the moment that one person sort of betrays another or even just makes them nervous, they get kicked to the curb. So much for unconditional love. I want to receive unconditional love, but I am in no way ready to grant it, even despite all of the ideas that they have about it. So Joe Walsh walks into this conversation with Joe Rogan, and Joe Walsh is very unprepared for this. I don't know if Joe Walsh hasn't been thinking enough about the definition of marriage, but he didn't do well in this conversation, basically because he didn't think about the evolution and the history of marriage. Now, the state, in a sense, has now sanctioned this modern evolution of marriage to be, as have many churches. Churches will play this game as well as everyone else. And basically, okay, so marriage is sort of the pinnacle of the romantic ideal, even as marriage is in many ways being deconstructed. And you can find, just the other day, Dr. Emily Ann Halt, who is co-founder and CCO of Join COA, psychoanalytic psychologist, tweeting to make psych concepts more digestible, promoter of self-awareness in all forms. She puts on Twitter, instead of till death do us part, how about for as long as this feels healthy, safe, and meaningful for both of us? So you can already see, in many ways, the deconstruction of universal marriage in what's been happening to the definition of marriage. And, well, how is that the deconstruction of universal marriage? Because you are family, you are tribe, till death do you part. That's the definition of family. And, in fact, even today, in conversations about, well, blood is thicker than water, that's the point. And so when death do you part is sort of put aside, a lot of these older definitions of marriage are sort of being laid to rest. And you find this in many other different places in the culture. So what marriage is becoming increasingly is an expression of peak romantic or psychological attraction. That is what the definition of marriage is becoming. And whereas Matt Walsh really fumbled the question poorly, he should have probably stopped Joe Rogan and said, well, this gay marriage doesn't necessarily affect my marriage, but the change of the definition of marriage impacts all marriages. And that's a better way of approaching the question, both within the church and within society. So I hope I've given this speech a number of times. You can probably find it a few times in my video catalog. This is basically the way to conduct the conversation. Now, you can have the conversation in terms of whether or not the definition of marriage should change. What you very quickly discover is now that when someone approaches marriage with the idea, till death do us part, how about for as long as this feels healthy, safe, and meaningful to both of us, the big sticking point very quickly becomes the children. Because no matter what people told you in the 70s, children care about their parents' marriage. It's a very big deal to children. And a book I can recommend Andrew Root, who's been on the channel a number of times, Children of Divorce. That book, when I read it, made the point very strongly that in many ways, children experience divorce as an ontological loss. There is something in them that they, in fact, are, as they are biologically, and materialists should be able to understand this, biologically, they should get the fact that they are made by two people. And with all of the reproductive engineering going on now, expect continued conversation around those sorts of issues. A sperm donor that has donated his sperm to 6, 8, 10, you know, there have been some strange cases where, in fact, the doctor has used his own sperm and has dozens, if not hundreds, of children out there. People care about this stuff. That doesn't just go away. And if the idea of marriage as making someone who is not part of your tribe or family as a part of your tribe or family, blood is thicker than water, the creation of legitimate heirs in terms of property and inheritance, if that goes away, that matters. The Pauline addition to marriage, that marriage, mutuality, monogamy, not just serial monogamy, but till death do us part monogamy, that's a very powerful ideal. And again, you hear echoes of that on shows like The Bachelor or Bachelorette, but the thing about ideals is that they pull people. So these are some points that Matt Walsh could have made to Joe Rogan and did much better on the 15 minutes of fumbling he did in this conversation. So that addresses your question. Hillary's birthday party. And there's my answer.